Hello, 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 and welcome to another Ramble with Lucas. Hey, I'm Lucas Kitchen. That was a weird intro. It's almost like something took over my body and started talking. Hey, there's a verse I want to look at today. But I want to lead into it. Hey, look, I promise this will still be a ramble, but I do have something I actually want to talk about. And I'm sure it'll ramble on into other things, but just to remind you, my goal is to keep you company for a little while and maybe put some thoughts in your head and just kind of talk while you work or whatever you are doing, commuting, or maybe you work in a steel forge and you are making small plates that go onto the SpaceX rocket. I don't know. Whatever you're doing, hopefully I keep you company for a little while and ramble a bit about some things that I think actually do matter and maybe could help you. So today I'm not going to look at the actual verse of the day from you version. I'm going to read a specific verse that just kind of came across my path and I've thought it was really interesting. It's in 1 Peter. And I will say, 1 Peter sometimes is kind of hard to understand, or just the Peter writings are a little bit hard to understand, which is kind of funny because like Mark, which we think is the collection of Peter's stories written down by John Mark, they're very easy to understand. But his letters are, they're just not as smooth. I don't know how to explain it exactly. It's like you're reading them and it's like, it's a lot packed into a sentence, you know. But it's great stuff, a lot of interesting things. But here I am giving a critique on the Bible. Sorry, I don't know. It's just my feeling on it, I guess. But check out this verse. He says, "But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God." And, you know, the idea here is like suffering is a thing that people can take credit for and even kind of take like a superiority for. Like, you know, sometimes you hear this in religious circles where somebody will say, well, we're being persecuted, you know, we're suffering. And it's like, well, what are you actually suffering for? Are you suffering because you were doing good? You were being righteous and people hate your righteousness because they hate God and they attack you. Of course that does happen. That absolutely does happen. And if that's what's happening, then it's commendable before God. I think that's like a way of saying you'll be rewarded for that. That you'll find that even in that, there is a rewarding path. I don't mean health and wealth and, you know, necessarily physical stability, but I think you'll be rewarded for, you know, enduring suffering the way that Christ endured suffering, especially when you endure the suffering that is because you've been righteous or because you've been good or, you know, whatever. But there's this other aspect that kind of looks similar and can feel a little bit similar from the outside and actually can be sort of co-opted. And we can pretend as if the thing I just talked about, doing good suffering, is what's going on, but it really isn't. And I feel like I've seen this in religious circles, in church circles, where someone is trained to be obnoxious in the way that they maybe evangelize, right? And so they're trained to be obnoxious. They're trained to be really aggressive. They're trained to be kind of insulting, you know, all of that. And the person training them knows that they're going to endure suffering for it, but not because of the message of Christ, but because they're being obnoxious. They're being cruel. They're being mean. They're being judgmental. They're being whatever. And so then it results in predictably suffering. Because the person who's mean gets beat up. And they were mean in the first place. They weren't sharing the love of Christ. They were kind of like using Bible bullets on people around them. And so then they endure the suffering. And then they come back with the story of, look, I was persecuted for the Lord. Let's celebrate. But it's not something to celebrate about if you endure suffering because you did wrong. And that's what Peter's saying. You know, another way to look at it is, let's say that that you steal money from your boss at work. Okay, you steal money, and then you get fired. And then because you're out of a job, you can't pay for your rent, and then and it just cascades down into every aspect of your life, right? And so, you're suffering, you know, you're suffering because of self-inflicted situation. You know, you chose to sin, and that sin resulted in the natural consequences of sin, you know? And so someone might look at that and say, I'm suffering for the Lord. You know, and here's the thing. You actually can endure those types of sufferings with poise and in a way that is rewardable. But we have to be careful about treating that sort of suffering as if you're suffering because you've done right. And that's a different thing. You know, it's just a different thing. I mean, like James said, endure every trial with joy, you know, maybe that's not really quite the sense of it. It's find joy in the fact that you are, going through a trial because the trials result in growth, right? And that is actually true of suffering that is self-inflicted or not. You can have self-inflicted suffering and then grow from it. And then, you know, face it with joy because you know that you'll grow. Like that can happen whether it's self-inflicted or not. But Peter's kind of making this different point that like, you know, don't take pride. Don't pretend as if you're being persecuted, as if you're some kind of righteous martyr. If the suffering you're actually experiencing is because of self-inflicted terrible decisions, you know, that's not the same as, you know, you're suffering and enduring because of something good that you've done. So interesting little contrast there. Can you grow from either side? Yes, obviously you can. And can you find joy in the trials on either side? Absolutely. But there is a difference. And it's important that we don't co-opt bad behavior and the suffering that results and use it as if we're a type of, you know, martyr in waiting. Because here's what happens when, like, say a kind of a twisted pastor or a leader uses that. They'll do that. And then that self-fulfilling process, where their people are trained to be obnoxious, then they are obnoxious, and then they get persecuted for it, or, you know, they get consequences for it. Then they take that back, they brag about it, which has to do with pride, of course, they brag about the suffering, and then the people in the in-group then come around them and say, oh, you're so brave for suffering for the Lord. And then it continues and it isolates that in-group from the out-group. It distances them from the people who they are supposedly trying to minister to. And I feel like I've seen this process within, I'm afraid to say it. I feel like I've seen this process maybe in a diet form, like this process in a watered down form. Within the Free Grace Circle, sometimes, not always, but sometimes what we're teaching each other to do is a little obnoxious. It can be offensive. It can be, I have a buddy who I'd say he's Free Grace really, but he's really been hurt by some of the approaches that are within the Free Grace movement. And one is that He got saved, but then didn't really have much of a thought on assurance, you know, on whether or not you could lose your salvation. But he had gotten saved. He knew it was Jesus's work. But he had kind of wondered if he possibly could lose his salvation or something like that, right? And so he wasn't real clear on it. And then he came into a Free Grace Church. And at the Free Grace Church, they told him, well, you weren't saved until you finally realized you can't lose your salvation. And so the result then was what they were saying is that his 15 years of walking with the Lord were all fake. And he was just like, no, that just can't be. They weren't fake. And he made a really great point when we were talking. He said, if those years before I understood assurance were fake, because I thought they were real, if they were fake, then whatever you're trying to sell to me right now could be fake. And it's a really great point. It's like if you can falsify 15 years of what he called walking with the Lord, then how would I ever have any confidence right now that I'm saved and actually walking with the Lord? Because he not only thought he was saved, but he thought he was walking with the Lord. So I think we see these kind of like hurtful patterns even within the Free Grace circle. And if you're not Free Grace, it's okay. It's kind of the broad name that kind of the group. It's not a denomination exactly, but it's kind of a grouping of people that are just, we really emphasize faith alone and Christ alone, you know, that kind of thing. And so within that circle, I've seen that there have been some hurtful patterns. And that's an example for me. That's an example of training people to try to convince others that they aren't saved and that what they thought was walking with the Lord really wasn't. And that is, I mean, this guy's words literally were, that was really damaging for me. And I agree with him. I think that was really damaging. It's very damaging. And is it possible for someone to be confused and, you know, and maybe have some fakeness going on? Yeah, obviously that's a possibility. But in this guy's case, he was like, it just wasn't fake. You know, he really was sincerely, seeking the Lord and walking with the Lord and had a lot of spiritual success in those years, you know. So in any case, it's damaging. And so when we train our people to do things that are obnoxious and offensive and even damaging, and then we tell them that what you're going to get as a result of that is actually like godly persecution, like persecution because you're being godly. Well, that's really damaging. That kind of like propagates the damage, right? Now, should we clarify the gospel constantly? Yes, obviously we should. We should clarify the gospel. We should talk about assurance. We should talk about eternal security. We should talk about faith alone and Christ alone. You know, we should talk about those things all the time. They should be repeated. You know, they should be in our phylacteries, so to speak. But if we train our people to do things that are damaging and then they get hurt by that, then obviously there's going to be fallout. And it's just kind of a self-defeating cycle. It's self-propagating, but like a self-defeating cycle where you just continue to isolate your people because you've basically set them up for persecution, but like persecution because they're being obnoxious. So I don't know. That stood out to me today. And I think that leads into like a vaguely related subject, which is what rambles are all about, right? So let me ramble on into this. This is vaguely related. It's like, let's say that you have found yourself in a situation where some of your behavior has hurt someone else, or someone else's behavior has hurt you. And in many cases, it's probably both, right? Like if you find that somebody is being mean to you, a lot of times it's because they feel like you've been mean to them, and that happened because, you know, it's a give and take, you know, and sometimes it isn't that way. Sometimes it's somebody had a bad day and you just happen to be the target, but then next time you're going to respond to them. I mean, I don't know, you know, where these things come from, but it's like, it's not always, it has to start somewhere. So it can't always be a back and forth. Sometimes it is one directional. Sometimes you have a person who is, They just are the type that say things that are maybe while being honest could be a bit insensitive and hurtful. Sometimes someone might see the world differently and they spill that worldview out in hurtful behaviors and phrases. But let's assume that the situation we're talking about is mendable. Let's say that you've gotten into a little bit of a conflict, with someone, and it is at the point where it could either escalate. Actually, every point in a conflict is a point where it could either escalate or it could de-escalate. I'm not clear on whether de-escalate is a word. I think it is, but I think you know what I mean. So you're at the point where it could escalate or it could de-escalate. And at this point, which is really any point in the conflict, you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to move towards love and move towards truth. And many times it is by de-escalating and disengaging from the emotional response that we want to do and reaching for the tools that are within the fruits of the Spirit. Love and patience and self-control. Like, do you need to say everything that's on your heart and your mind to that person? No, I don't think so. And I think self-control would lead us to not say everything. We want to say the things that will mend the relationship, grow the person, help them mature, help us to mature, and not create more of a trial and not get us beaten for doing wrong, as Peter said. And so really often in conflicts, when I hear people talk about conflicts, what I hear them saying is what the other person did. And this goes from like toddlers on up to people that are, you know, plenty old to be mature. It's a high focus on what the other person did and why it was wrong. You'll usually hear fairness being kind of, presented as the chief reason why it's okay to complain, you know, about the situation, is it just wasn't fair what they did, you know, but here's the odd thing. If you go talk to the other person, which I actually kind of like to do, by the way, it's just kind of it's one of the things that I really believe in. It's not always easy to do, but like I really believe in, if there's somebody getting griped about, to go talk to that person who's getting griped about, because they probably have an opinion too, and they probably have felt, you know, whatever the opposite is. They probably felt hurt and they might be responding in hurt, you know? And so if you can get past the symptomatic surface stuff and get down to what the centerpiece is, the thing that's driving the conflict, it makes a huge difference. But you can't do that if you don't talk. Okay. So like you need to talk. If you've got a conflict in your life, you need to talk to that person. And if the conflict continues, you need to continue to talk to that person. Now, there are outliers. For instance, if there is a huge imbalance of power and it's dangerous for you, then clearly what you need is probably closure. So if there's someone who is dangerous or abusive and is like likely to go for the knife and cut your ear off or something, well, I'm not saying you need to go put yourself in that situation. You need closure from that situation. Sometimes closure still is going to be talking. You need to probably escape from a situation like that. And also call the police. I mean, you know, so much of abusive situations, it's like seek the authorities, whatever authority is above the person that's the abuser, you know, seek that authority. And cause like we're in a country where abuse isn't okay. It's literally against the law. You know, so I'm not proposing that. And so when I say conflict, I mean generally a conflict of basically equals. And I don't mean as in Peter, I don't mean a disciplinarian situation. Like if you did something wrong and you receive the discipline, that is not the same thing as a conflict. Like my son, he's five now, but like when he was pretty young, he's very verbal. When he was young, if he got a spanking for doing something wrong, he would say, "You hurt my feelings by spanking me." I'm like, "Well, I bet I did, but that's a little different than what we usually mean by hurting your feelings. Hurting your feelings is like conflict language. Discipline is separate." Okay. So I'm carving out what conflict isn't. It isn't a discipline situation and it's not an abusive situation. Okay. So we're not talking about those. We're talking about, conflict between essentially equals. Now that could be with a boss and an employee because they're essentially equals, right? We're in a free country. You're not a slave. You're not a servant. And so if it's a conflict, if it's a hurt my feelings situation, you have the right, and I would even say maybe the obligation to deal with it directly. Now, sometimes dealing with it could mean that you determine not to talk about it. Like if it's not sin, like a lot of people pull out Matthew 18 and they say, well, you know, Matthew 18 says you got to go talk to him. But actually Matthew 18 is in situations with sin and it seems to be in the context of the church because it talks about going to that person and then bringing two or three witnesses and then bring them before the church. It's like, well, you're not going to bring an unbeliever before the church. You wouldn't even bring someone from a different church before your church. You know, so you got to think about that in terms of the whole process. It's like, what is the context there? You know, so it's sin. And so like, I've had a situation where someone was using Matthew 18 with me, but I disagreed that it was a sin. I said, I don't think sin was done here, you know? And they opted not to bring it in front of the church. Maybe for that, I don't know why exactly, but they didn't go through the whole process, but they said that process applied. And I was like, I don't think it does in situations where there's a disagreement on whether there was sin because other witnesses were brought into it. And some of those witnesses said, I don't think there's a sin here. And some of the witnesses did think there was a sin. It was a situation where I had said some things about, this guy and he felt like he had been slandered. I felt like, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's what happened. I think I was seeking help. You know, it was that kind of thing. And so there was a disagreement on whether Matthew 18 would even be invoked, you know? So Matthew 18 has a specific application, but in my opinion, it's when there is sin and it's clearly sin and the witnesses and all the witnesses, you know, that are called would agree. And when you're within the same, you know, you're within the same church and, you know, so anyway, now the concept can still work, but I just think we have to be careful in saying we're invoking Matthew 18 because it's not quite Matthew 18 if you're trying to deal that way with an unbeliever, for instance. Now, can you still learn from Matthew 18? Yeah. You can still approach that person and you could even bring two or three witnesses, but you don't have that final step usually. So. So anyway, I don't know. It's some difficulty there. So let's say you're in this conflict and generally speaking, I think what we see in scripture is that, the way to deal with conflict is to talk to the person, you know, and that's at least the floor level of what we do get from Matthew 18 is like the value is talking to him, you know, and there's other scripture like that. However, there is other scripture that talks about dropping a matter, letting a matter go. And I think if it's not a sin, I think you do have that opportunity to let a matter go. So that's a thing. And so I want to talk about like, if you're in the conflict, if you're in this situation, it's not a discipline situation and it's not an abusive situation. It is really a conflict and you're thinking about how to respond. I just kind of want to go over some different things I've heard and kind of give them my assessment. One of the things that I've heard is that some people are very strong on the subject of conflict conversations need to happen face to face. They make a big deal about this, you know, like you need to always do conflict conversations face to face. But here's what I've noticed. The people that say that are usually really good at face-to-face conversations. They're usually really, they're either really prepared or they're really good at talking on their feet, so to speak. And so they say that because they have often, I think, they have often gotten success in that area. They have noticed over the years when they do face-to-face conversations, they often get what they want because they're really good at it. People that are different, okay, so like there's a person that I know who says, you know, you really need to do face-to-face conversations. Okay. So this person says that, but they won't have a face-to-face conversation until they are very prepared, you know, so they will take a very long time to prepare and then they'll come to a meeting extremely prepared. And so it's a little bit of a misnomer to say face-to-face conversation is what you need, because it's like, well, why not do the face-to-face conversation when you're unprepared? Because the person that you're about to talk to is going to be unprepared because they don't know what you're about to talk to them about. So I would say face-to-face conversation immediately, not after a long period of preparing your case, you know, or like putting together all the details and making sure that you know exactly how you're going to really get them. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is like it is valuable to have a face-to-face if you can, if it's equal, if both parties are kind of equally skilled at speaking and both parties have a similar level of preparedness. So if both parties are aware of what's happening and what is going to be talked about and what if there's an accusation or if there's a hurt feeling, both parties know that, then yeah, face-to-face is great. But there are circumstances where a real-time face-to-face conversation is not the best. And I'm actually going to say I think that's maybe the majority of situations is it's possibly better not to do it face to face. And let me just make the case. And it comes from something my older brother brought up to me years ago that I thought was just really brilliant. He said when he would have, you know, like say an argument, I mean, he loves his wife. They're great, you know, but occasionally they would have an argument. And my brother was kind of the quiet sort. You know, like when we were younger, now you may not know it, knowing him, he's really great. He's an advertising guy. He's really great presenting and talking. But growing up, he would often let me kind of be the mouthpiece of our club. You know, I was the one that was talking and he would kind of let me speak for him, you know. And so he's a little bit on the quieter side in his natural habitat. And so he tends to want a little bit of time to think about what he's going to say. You know, so that's why like in his agency, he's always prepared when he's talking to a client. He knows what he's trying to sell. He knows, you know, what the ad copy is and stuff. He's really prepared. But on the fly, he's still really good at it on the fly, but he does like to be prepared and he likes to have a little bit of time. Now, in the context of him, and his wife, I don't think they argue much, but when they do, she is very verbal. She's a school teacher. She teaches all day long. She's really quick. She can think and speak quickly, you know, and she can, in a sense, this is the sense he gave me, she can maneuver around him, verbally. She can kind of like circle around and she's just faster with her words, you know, and so if it's an argument and they are, you know, and they're talking and they're trying to, you know, she's just faster than he is, you know, and he can't, like, by the time he's ready to say the one thing, she's already, you know, spoken on that subject and moved on. And it's like, he can't, he just, you know, he just a different speed. I think this is really common for men and women. I heard that a long time ago, women can process about 600 words a minute. Now, most things that you encounter aren't 600 words a minute. We speak at, I'm probably speaking at about 180 words a minute, you know. Now I could speed that up a little bit, but I cannot, my brain is not designed to process words as quickly as a woman's brain is. God made us that way, you know, and I'm glad he did. Men have a different strength in different areas, generally speaking, in their brain space. And women, this is a place where women can outperform men. It's in verbosity. And so what my brother discovered that really helped him, and this shifted my thinking on conflicts. This is just this one little comment he made. He said what he realized is if he'll just go outside and sit in the car and text with her, he'd get on his phone and he'll text her, they can actually get something done, you know. Not to say that they never got anything done by talking, but I just mean like when it starts to get a little escalated, he realized. And by the way, I don't know if they do this anymore. This was like 10 years ago he said this, or 15 years, I don't even know. But he realized if he would go out, he'd sit in his car and he would text with her, which is kind of funny, but he said what it does is it gives him long enough to think about what he's trying to say and to think about what she said. And it starts to de-escalate, you know. It doesn't immediately de-escalate, but it does start to de-escalate, especially if he or she wants to de-escalate, because it removes that feeling of frustration. And so I actually think, not just because of that, but because I've experienced a number of situations with conflict, I actually think that doing conflict in writing can have huge advantages as long as you're committed to a solution. Now, if both parties aren't committed to a solution, in writing or verbal can break down, right? But if both parties are committed to a solution, I actually think you can get to the solution faster by writing. Maybe I shouldn't say faster. It's not actually faster. It's actually slower. But that's the point. It slows you down. And I'll tell you, one of the things that happens is if you're willing to not hit send right away, you will edit yourself and not say things that you would later wish that you didn't say. So in the midst of a conflict, for me, I will actually ask the person if we happen to be talking, you know, face to face or on the phone or whatever, I'll ask, do you mind if we do this in writing so that I have time to think about what I'm saying and what I'm feeling and think about what you're saying? And so I've done, you know, I've literally actually said that, not just did it. Now, one of the concerns though is that it can go off the rails and you can say things that you don't mean. So you've got to follow, you don't have to, but I'm going to suggest that you follow a few rules. Just personal rules if you take a conflict into writing. One of the rules is you never hit the send button. And here's what I mean is you always schedule a send. Okay, so you write it, but you don't send it right away. You schedule it 2, 3, 4 hours out, you know, and any email platform can do this. If you're doing it through email, actually your text messages can do this too. You can schedule it to send a little bit later. And what that does is that gives you the option to, once you've calmed down even more, which hopefully you are calm based on what I'm going to say in a minute, but once you've calmed down a little bit more and you've gotten out of the fervor of writing, whatever it is you're writing, you can come back to it later and say, is this really what needs to be said? And before it, you know, before it gets sent, and then you can cancel the send and rewrite it or decide you want to go a different route. So in the midst of a conflict, schedule your messages. I would say write messages and schedule your messages and don't send them right away. Because as soon as you've seen it, it's been said, you know. So really what doing it in writing does is it puts a distance between the thought and the execution. And the execution in a verbal conversation just has to happen quickly because you respond quickly. By the way, if you're in a verbal conflict, a really good practice is to just tell the person, hey, I'm going to take a long minute to think about this and I need to just sit here quietly and think about it. And if you have to turn your back or whatever, It's really hard to do that with somebody, I know, but like, it is way better than saying something you don't mean or saying the wrong thing and it's sending you off on some rabbit trail that they're going to eventually demolish anyway, and you're going to be back where you started. So if you have to do it verbally, which sometimes you do, sometimes you're just pressed into that situation, you need to be comfortable saying, I'm going to need to take a minute. You know, I'm going to sit here quietly. Please don't talk while I'm thinking, you know, that kind of thing. And most people will let you do that. It is a little uncomfortable, but most people will let you do that. Some people can't resist and they will just talk through your quiet moment. And if that's the case, I mean, you could easily say, look, I need a minute to think. And so I'm going to have to step out of the room if you can't just give me a minute to think, you know? And so that there's another thing is when I get upset, it's not a conflict exactly, but when I get upset with my kids, a lot of times I'll step out of the room. I'll just say, you know what? I need to calm down. And I'll tell them that I'm feeling mad. I need to calm down. Let me step out. Sometimes I just blow up and yell at them, and I'm just admitting that that's one of my weaknesses. I happen to be working on it, but, okay. So in writing, schedule, that's another thing. Here's another thing about conflict writing. It's like a category. I have spent, gosh, I might have written as many words in conflict writing as I have in books. I don't know, maybe not, but I have written an incredible amount in the context of conflict, but I have sent only a very small fraction of what's been written. So and the more intense the conflict, the greater the ratio disparity becomes. Okay. So when I'm in a conflict, I'm making it sound like I'm in conflicts all the time. I'm not, but I have had some serious ones and they've been long lasting. And so it's given me some practice, and I think given the other person a practice, and they'd probably had some interesting things to say too. But, so one of the things that happens is if you commit to saying, we're going to do this in writing, and we're going to play fair, and we're going to try not to say things we don't mean. We're going to take our time. We're going to schedule this in. But here's another thing that happens is you need to understand that the first message you write is probably not the one you're going to send. This happens all the time. When the emotions are high, I write a very long first message. And I don't realize I'm doing this until later. I write it. I let it just say whatever it is I'm feeling. And then usually I don't just delete it because I just can't stand to delete it. But what I do is I'll copy and paste it into a notes folder and then I start over and I just push that away. Sometimes I'll delete it later. Sometimes I actually will just delete it. That does happen, but sometimes I save it, but mostly just so that I don't have that frantic feeling of, oh, I just wasted time. Because the thing is, I didn't just waste time. What I did was I just did a therapy session pretending as if I was going to send this, and then I didn't send it. And then I rewrite it. And usually the second one, if it's really high tension, the second one isn't right either. It's not that it's wrong exactly. It's not that it's right or wrong. It's just, it's like, oh, this is going to escalate. And that's my question usually is, you know, will this escalate the conflict, or will this de-escalate? Right? So I'll write a second one. It's usually shorter, but it's usually more to the point. Then I'll write a third one. And there are times when I have spent weeks, writing and deleting, responses, usually an email because it's, you know, longer, and then never sent anything at all. And in the greatest conflicts of my life, not greatest as in fun, but like the most substantial conflicts of my life, that's really how it went, is, you know, a month or two. And the person that I'm in conflict with probably thinks that, I've just ignored, or, you know, decided not to respond or whatever, but that's not the case. Sorry for that weird sound. I was using my teeth to scratch my lower lip there. How strange. The person probably thinks I've just blown them off, but I haven't. I'm over here thinking about how to respond, and I'm anticipating that all of the ways that I've so far thought to respond are going to escalate the tension and create more trouble. And you know, probably the person who I'm in conflict with, if I'm in conflict, they're probably just thinking, well, just tell me and that'll be fine. And then we'll, you know, but if we got to that point where I'm writing and deleting responses like day in, day out, like for a long period of time, what it means is that I've actually tried a number of things and things didn't work. And maybe I'm just too dense to know what to do, but like just I've tried, we've tried a lot of things and it didn't work. And each time it escalates and it doesn't go anywhere. And so that process though has yielded, like if a message works, you know, if there's a message that de-escalates, it is often a result of that process. It is rarely like the very just first message that was sent, you know, especially if I'm mad, you know, it's rarely going to be that first message that's successful. So be willing to delete what you write and write it again. And then ask yourself, you know, and you do different things in those passes, in those second writings, those third writings. One of the things that I'll do is I'll read through it and say, is there anything in here that's accusatory? Am I accusing them of anything? Because by the point in the conflict, you probably don't need to be accusing more. If you've already stated your case and said, you know, you hurt my feelings in this way, you don't need to keep saying that. You do need to keep talking, but you don't need to keep repeating that same thing, you know. If you're at the stage where you're letting them know that they've hurt your feelings, it is really valuable to try to do that in a way that isn't accusing them of anything, but is talking about the emotion that their behavior has produced, right? And you see the difference. It's like, because most accusations assume you know what they were trying to do. Most accusations assume that you know their motives. And if you know, no matter how much you think you know their motives, you don't. You don't know their motives. And unless they say what their motives are, but even then you could question it, you know, like maybe they don't know what their motives are. Maybe they don't know why they said that. Maybe they're just repeating something they heard. I mean, who knows? You don't know what their motives are. And so, if you think you know their motives, it's probably pretty valuable. It's been valuable in my experience to keep that stowed away and to read through it and say, am I assigning motives anywhere? Am I assuming that I know what they were trying to do? Am I assuming? No, you don't know any of that. But what you do know is that what happened hurt your feelings. Or what happened made you mad, or what happened made you feel belittled. And so it's like really important to think about what is the feeling that it gave me. Because think about the difference in these two statements. You're a real jerk to me. Well, that's a statement of that statement has embedded in it a lot of assumptions, actually. That's really different than this statement. Hey, my feelings were really hurt the last time we talked. I mean, do you see the difference there? Most people would say, they would probably start by saying, I'm sorry, did I do something to, you know, to hurt your feelings? But if you start with like, you were a jerk last time you talked to me, that's going to put the person in a defensive posture. You don't want them to be in a defensive posture. You want them to be an open flower, you know, you want them to be open. And so the way to openness is to show vulnerability. And it is a vulnerable move to say how it made you feel, because you're admitting that you have a weakness. You know, if I say my feelings were hurt, I'm admitting that I have a sensitive nerve on some subject that you touched on, you know. And so that conflict is really, I mean, that way of dealing with it is really important. You read back through what you've written and you ask yourself, am I accusing? Am I assigning motives? Am I assuming that I know things that I don't actually know? And it can be hard to realize what you think you know that you don't actually know. But you've got to self regulate here. The other thing is you need somebody that isn't mad about the situation. I mean, like when it's really heated, and you're working on a written response to somebody, it's really important to find somebody that isn't mad about the situation to read over it and give you a sense of, like, say, your tone and what you're saying. And that's not always easy to find, I know, and it's a hassle, but when it counts, it's worth getting counsel, right? And so having someone vet what you're saying and help you see it for its tone and for its, that's a really valuable, and I've done that. Sometimes I've made the mistake of asking someone who is also mad about the situation, if this, you know, how does this email read? And they haven't spotted it because they're like, well, yeah, of course he was a jerk to you, you know, because they think he was a jerk or whatever. And I'm not talking about a specific situation, but I generally don't use the word jerk, but just, you know, kind of for illustration purposes. So the person that you have vetted actually matters a lot. Because we tend to have the people that kind of already agree with us as our closest allies, and those people that already agree sometimes are trying to see us get justice, and that's not what we're trying to do in conflict, you know. I mean, I know we think we're trying to get justice in conflict, but you don't want justice. Your flesh wants justice, but you don't want justice. What you want is you want to maintain a meaningful relationship with that person. Even if you don't think that's what you want, that's what you want. You want to have a real, meaningful relationship with them. And the amazing thing about allowing someone to blossom, to open up, to be vulnerable, is very often, not every case, but very often what will happen is when the defenses go down, they will often recognize that you have experienced a bit of injustice at their own hand, and they will often apologize for it once the relationship is moving towards restoration. It's just amazing. I mean, it's what God has put in us, you know. And of course, there are people that are fringe cases where this isn't the case. But most people that you're dealing with, they're normal people. They're your friends. They're your family. They're, you know, sometimes not. Sometimes you're dealing with an insane person. But for the most part, very, very rarely is it all that person's fault, you know. Now, I'm not saying that the victim should be blamed. That's why I said that we're not talking about abuse and we're not talking about discipline situations. We're talking about real conflict between essentially equals. Okay, so scheduling, doing it in writing, scheduling, having someone vet it, writing and deleting and rewriting, these things are... they're fantastic for just making sure that you don't say things that you shouldn't and honestly don't want to say. I mean, your flesh wants to say things that aren't going to help the conflict, because your flesh would like to fight with their flesh. I mean, you know, if you let your mind wander, you probably start wandering towards punching them in the mouth or whatever, but you don't want your flesh to have the conflict. You want to force that person to have their conflict with your spirit. I think maybe that is my final thought for now. I'm realizing I have a lot of thoughts on conflict, so maybe I should do another episode sometime. But I really like this idea that you want to force the person that you're in a conflict with to have their conflict with your spirit, not with your flesh. Because you potentially, if they're a believer, you can potentially trigger them to then step out of the flesh and into the spirit, so to speak. You know, but if you have your conflict in the flesh, it's not going to go well. You know, I mean, you could come up with like a strategic solution where both of you have, you know, it's like, you know, the collateral damage is limited or something like that. But honestly, that's not good. What you want is the restoration of the relationship. And what you need is you need to call on the power that's in you, if you're a believer, which is the Holy Spirit, you know. And so you want to have a conflict in the Holy Spirit. You know, you want to operate out of that part of yourself, or it's going to be ugly. It's not going to have that godly fruit of the Spirit conclusion, you know. You might could get some kind of peace treaty, but you won't actually have peace, you know. if you do it in the flesh. And so you want your conflicts to happen in the spiritual part of yourself. And I think now that I'm really just kind of thinking through this, the suggestions I'm giving really are just a way to slow down enough to not let your flesh drive the thing. And so maybe I should introduce this, that in those moments, if you decide to have your conflict over text message or email or whatever, when you write it and you reread it, you should introduce prayer into it. And literally pray, Lord, is this the response you want me to give? And then go take a walk and think about it and pray some more, you know. Maybe even trying to think of scripture that can guide the process. I'm telling you, it makes a huge difference. But if you respond in your flesh, well, that makes a huge difference too, but not the difference you want. It's just a mess. And so whatever method it is that you use in having a conflict and working through it, it needs to be pointing you toward your mindset on Christ, your mindset on the eternal perspective, your mindset on godly things, on things above. That's what you need. That's what you need in the conflict. And that's what that person needs too. And they can grow through it and you can grow through it, but you will grow through it and they will too in some way. But the best growth is when you're doing it in the Spirit. And so whatever it is, you want to return to fellowship, which is one of the three main things that helps you set your mind on things above. Conflicts can really set your mind on things of the earth, but if you use it, a conflict can help you set your mind on things above if you'll take that godly perspective, you know, if you'll take that eternal perspective. So I think that's all I'm going to do for now. But maybe we'll do another episode. I don't know. I just went and went and went. And here we are at like, what are we up to, an hour? We're not up to an hour yet, but we're not far from it. So, hopefully I won't have any more conflicts anytime soon. But if I do, maybe I'll learn something new that I can share. So I'll ask you guys this. What have you learned from conflict? You can put it in the comment section or if you have my phone number, send me a voicemail or give me a call and, you know, maybe I'll put your recording on the next episode or whatever. So, all right, guys, thanks for listening. See you.